happy to be back with you. On my mind, utter sadness and frustration. I'm sure so many of you share over the premeditated killings in Las Vegas earlier this week and the, so far, apparent lack of national will to find a way to end this kind of horror. On the podcast this week, I spoke with David Cole of the ACLU about our country's gun culture.
There is this very strong ethic in America about individualism, about distrust of government, and about people taking care of themselves. And guns are a central part of that.
Then, author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, on his new book, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. It's a collection of Coates' essays published for The Atlantic during Obama's presidency, culminating in the election of Donald Trump.
The main question for Trump was not even whether something was good or bad policy, was it liberal or conservative, but was Obama for it?
First, David Cole. He's National Legal Director for the ACLU. Hey, David.
Hi, Diane.
It's great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
So, after the extraordinary carnage in Las Vegas, David, why do you think that gun violence has become so prevalent in our society today? Is it just who we are? Is it simply part of our history? Is it the prevalence of guns? Is it the action or inaction of the Congress? What do you think is going on?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. I think the prevalence of guns is a huge part of it. There are 300 million people in the United States. I think there are close to that many guns. It's over 200 million guns out there. So we are awash in guns. And if you're awash in guns, then the risk that disputes will escalate into gun violence is much greater. You know, if you're living in the United Kingdom, where they have very strict restrictions on guns, very few people have guns. A fight breaks out or a dispute arises between two rival gangs. The likelihood that it's going to be resolved through murder is much smaller, and the murder rates are much lower. So that the number of guns that we have is a huge part of the problem, and you know that's one of the things that makes gun regulation very difficult, is that the guns are just out there. The barn door has been opened, and it's not easy to get them out of there because guns last for a very, very long time. But I think also there is this very strong ethic in America about individualism, about distrust of government, and about people taking care of themselves. And guns are a central part of that. So I think for many of the people who believe strongly in the right to bear arms, they are people who see a gun as a critical part of their ability to engage in self-defense. And there's a huge divide between those who live in rural areas and those who live in urban areas on this question, understandably, because if you live in an urban area, number one, you see the costs of guns because you see the tremendous carnage on a daily basis. We pay attention to things like Las Vegas, but the real tragedy of gun violence is the gun violence that happens every day in inner cities in America. We don't pay attention to it because it's a drip, drip, drip every day, but that's the real cost. So if you live in a city, you see that cost, number one. Number two, you see that the police are around and close by and, can step in to resolve disputes in a realistic and reasonably timely manner. If you live in the middle of nowhere in the country, who's going to come to support you if you're threatened? And so I think people are much more likely to think, look, ultimately, I'm responsible for my own defense, and so I want to have a gun to defend myself. And that's why I think when you look at polls, you see really radically different views on whether and to what extent guns should be regulated among rural voters and among urban voters.
Everybody up till now has been so focused on the word terrorism. I mean, how do we define terrorism anymore? It strikes me that this was an act of terrorism, but in fact, this guy had no criminal background. He had, as far as we know, no affiliation with any other organization. How do we determine what is terrorism and what isn't anymore?
So, I mean, the widely accepted view of terrorism is using violence for a political motive to inflict fear in the people to achieve some political end. That's the basic idea of terrorism. You're using violence for a political end. And I think the reason that people question whether this was an act of terrorism is we have no idea whether this guy had any political end in mind. If you're part of a group that's seeking to cause the state to react in a way that will build, sympathy on your side, then you may be engaged in terrorism. If you're just a deranged individual who chooses to slaughter people, it inflicts terror, to be sure, but it's not designed to further any political end. So I don't think people think this, the kid who went into Sandy Hook and killed all those children, I don't think people think he was a terrorist, even though he was a heinous criminal. And I think that's the same is true with respect to, at least as far as we know, the same is true with respect to this individual. It's also not clear what turns on the label terrorism. What he did is a crime. It is multiple murders. They can be punished very strongly if the person survives. So it's not clear why adding the label terrorism really moves the ball forward. Or not, with respect to how we deal with the problem. If there's a link to a group, then we understand the group may be the source of future problems, and so we may want to focus on that group. But if not, then I'm not sure why people get upset about whether you label it terrorist or not.
So you think it makes no difference in our minds whether this is an act of terrorism or whether it's simply the act of one man desiring to kill many other people?
Well, I think it does have an effect. There is a difference. I'm not sure there's a difference that matters in terms of what the state can or should do, but I do think there's a difference. The planes flew into the World Trade Center and killed 3,000 people in one go round. People react to that with more fear, more questions than an earthquake that kills 3,000 people. One is sort of an act of God. It happens. It's horrific. It's terrible. But we don't have any control over it, and it's not the act of a human being, an intentional act of a human being. This is an intentional act of a human being. If it's an intentional act of a group of human beings that have come together to inflict this kind of harm on people, then we have more to fear than if it's the act of a deranged individual who has, inflicted this horrific damage and then killed himself so that the the cause for concern is at least in this specific instance is gone with the death of the individual.
David, just after the rampage, there were right-wing websites reportedly sending Facebook messages and news stories that were completely false. You know, we're now getting into this whole question of free speech. It used to be so simple. You know, you cannot stand up in a theater and yell fire. It has become so much more complicated.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, both, I think, the advances in technology that have given small groups of individuals or even an individual the ability to really wreak widespread carnage, coupled with the Internet and the ability of the Internet to really reach so much further, I think, you know, it raises serious questions about how we govern ourselves as a society when the technology has given people the ability to inspire everyone in the world. You know, they can reach everybody, at least in theory, through the Internet, and then one or a few individuals can really cause a tremendous amount of harm. It's a scary world that we live in.
And in the aftermath of Charlottesville, you weighed in on the defense of free speech. Now, there is a situation where mob violence really occurred as a result of, I gather, what was intended as a demonstration and a counter-demonstration. Tell us your thoughts.
Well, yeah, so Charlottesville was, another terrible tragedy. We at the ACLU, as we often do, we get involved when cities seek to shut down protests or seek to limit protests in a content based way, a viewpoint-based way, and we represented the individual who sought the permit, Jason Kessler. He swore under oath that the permit was for a peaceful rally, a nonviolent rally, criticizing the city's decision to take down a Robert E. Lee memorial. As we know, then the city sought to move after giving him a permit, sought to move him away from the monument, over a mile away from the monument, but was unable to identify any reason for doing so. And they allowed the counter protesters to stay where the monument was, but they moved the protesters a mile away. And the court found that was unjustified, and it was treating people differently based on whether they were protesters or counter protesters, and you have to treat them the same. And so they said the protest should go on. But then the city did a very bad job of keeping the protesters and the counter protesters apart. It grew into a kind of mob violence situation, and then one individual, again, it illustrates the harm that one individual can do. One individual drives his car into a group of counter-protesters and kills an individual. So it's a really tragic situation. But I think, as you saw 1 week later in Boston, this is a situation that can be policed appropriately. There, too, you had protests by white supremacist groups. There, too, you had counter-protesters. It turned out they had about 50 protesters and about 40,000 counter-protesters marching for love and unity rather than for hate and division. But the police kept them apart, and there was no violence. And the message sent to the world was, you know, these individuals who are propounding hate and white supremacy are sort of puny anonymities that that the vast majority of people reject out of hand without it leading to violence. So I think what that illustrates is that when the police do their job and regulate protest fairly and appropriately, people can speak. And when people speak, bad ideas get rejected. But when the police don't do their job, things can get out of hand, as they very much did in Charlottesville. So we responded afterwards at the ACLU and said, we continue to defend the right of people to protest, and we continue to oppose government efforts to suppress people's speech or treat people differently because of the content of their views. But we do not support violence. And we, in particular, will not represent people who want to march while armed. We think it's a perfectly legitimate condition for towns and cities and states to say, if you want to protest, leave your weapons at home. That's part of what the problem was at Charlottesville. People came brandishing all sorts of weapons. That serves no First Amendment interest. And it undermines First Amendment interest because it's likely to lead to escalation, which will then, lead to violence and or shutting down of the speech altogether.
You know, both Charlottesville and Boston represent clearly the divides that have always been there but have somehow sharpened under the Trump administration. Has the ACLU reconsidered any of its approaches, considering that the partisanship, as we've seen, has grown and in some cases has become more violent?
So, yeah, we are. I mean, we're not abandoning our sort of bottom line principle, which is that we believe speech should be protected regardless of its content, short of it coming to the point of inciting violence. That has been our position for about 80 years, and we've reconsidered it on many occasions, and we've always come to the same conclusion, which is that it's not in our interest to give government officials the power to decide who gets to speak. If you're concerned about the Trump administration, if you're concerned about the kinds of officials who have come to power in various parts of our country, including in the White House, the last thing you'd want to do is give them the power to be able to determine which speech should be permitted and which speech should not be permitted. So that continues to be our position. But we're very concerned about the violence, which is why we announced this position that we will not represent people who are marching armed. We've created within the ACLU a working group on looking at how, whether, and when we take on these cases which involve very controversial speech and where there might be a violence might arise and where the client's views are counter to everything else we stand for, equality, dignity, racial justice, and the like. And so, you know, there are tough questions that we're asking ourselves. But I think at the end of the day, you know, even if you despise, as we do, the message of groups like white supremacists, I think the question you have to ask is, do you want to empower government officials to make choices about what content they deem to be politically correct or not? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, most of us don't want the government to have that power, and particularly if you are either a dissident or a minority member of a minority group, the last thing you'd want to do is give that power to a government that is ultimately going to respond to majoritarian wishes, not the interests of the disadvantaged.
David, in terms of Facebook ads And Congress is apparently investigating the so-called extreme ones. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that as they are used to disseminate false information to voters.
This is a really tough problem, Diane, and I'm not sure what the right answer is. But I'll say this, you know, for the same reason that I am skeptical about giving Donald Trump the power to decide what speech should be permitted and what speech should be censored, I'm also, you know, concerned about giving Facebook or Google the power to make those decisions. You know, we don't trust government. We generally don't trust a centralized authority to decide what speech is permissible and what speech is impermissible. That route is the route of the censor. It's been tried. It doesn't work. And so we in this country anyway have gone the other way and said, no, we shouldn't empower a central figure to decide what's true, what's false, what's right, what's wrong. We should let the market decide it. Let a thousand flowers bloom. Let people speak. And the idea is, at least in theory, that that's more likely to lead to the right result than empowering a centralized authority. That is why we have a First Amendment. Google and Facebook are not the government, but they're very, very powerful centralized authorities, and they run and control the platforms for the exchange of ideas. And so it's dangerous to give them the ability to start to become a censor for many of the same reasons that it's dangerous to give Donald Trump the power to be a censor. And if the cost of that is that we have to tolerate fake news, I'm afraid that may be the cost we have to pay.
And one more question about the Supreme Court and its new term that began this week. What are the issues that the ACLU is most concerned about?
Well, we have five cases before the Supreme Court this term, and they're all issues that in which we are defending rights of equality, of privacy, of religious freedom, of voting rights against the Trump administration, which is on the other side.
Of democracy itself.
Of democracy itself, right. So the case that was argued yesterday, we filed an amicus brief in the case involving whether and to what extent partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution. That really is about the future of democracy itself. And we believe the court has to step in, that you can't have a system in which the legislators pick the voters rather than the voters picking the legislators, and that's what we've come to in states where the majority draws the lines in such a way to entrench itself so that no matter how the vote comes out, they remain the majority. That's what the Republicans have done in Wisconsin. Democrats have done it in other states. It's just anti-democratic, and we think very, very troubling, and we think the court should step in. But we have other cases. We have a case involving essentially the future of privacy in the digital age. It's called Carpenter versus United States. It's whether the government can get access to the data that your phone company collects about you simply because you carry your phone around with you on a daily basis. And when you carry your phone around with you, you are always connecting. Your phone is connecting up to cell towers. The phone companies keep a record of what cell tower you're connecting to, where, and in what quadrant. And when you put all that information together, you can get a pretty intimate portrait of where someone has traveled 24/7 for months at a time. In our case, the government got over four months worth of where this Mr. Carpenter had traveled 24/7 with his phone. And our argument is that that's an invasion of privacy, that we have a reasonable expectation that nobody except ourselves knows where we travel 24/7 over an extended period of time. And the government, if the government's going to get that information, it should have to get a warrant. It should have to have probable cause.
I want to ask what you think the likelihood is that the Supreme Court will indeed rule in your favor and in favor of the people on gerrymandering.
It's often hard to predict from these arguments, but we know from prior cases that Justice Kennedy is the deciding vote, and he seemed to be quite troubled by the position that the party opposing any judicial review of partisan gerrymandering was presenting. And so I think I would predict, and I'm always cautious about predicting what the court would do, but I think the court will conclude that Wisconsin went over the line, that Wisconsin, by entrenching the Republican majority for a decade, no matter what the voters voted, that's too far, and that there is a role for courts to play in ensuring that our democracy remains one in which voters select their representatives and not the other way around.
David, on that note, I'm going to say thank you for your time and your efforts on behalf of the people of the United States of America.
Well, thank you, Diane. Thank you for educating the people of America on so many issues.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
And now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. I caught up with Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. Ta-Nehisi Coates, how great to be with you again.
Great to be back.
The title of your new book, We Were 8 Years in Power, goes back to the 1895 Constitutional Convention. Tell us what was going on.
Sure. The 1895 Constitutional Convention, in South Carolina specifically, was convened to, as it sounds, rewrite the Constitution, but of particular historical importance to complete the disenfranchisement of black people in South Carolina, who at that point were the majority of people living in South Carolina, by the way. And the title comes from Congressman Thomas Miller, who had represented his state in Congress immediately after the Civil War during the period of Reconstruction. And it comes from a plea he made to the 1895 Constitutional Convention that began, We Were 8 Years in Power. And what he said was, we were 8 years in power, and I don't have an exact quote of it, but basically that, we reconstructed the state, we established the public school system, we established all these, sort of public works. The infrastructure of the state was established by us coming right out of slavery. Why would you do this? Why would you disenfranchise us? And writing some 40 years later, the great historian and activist and writer W.E.B. Du Bois, identified the basic error in Thomas Miller's query. And what he said was, Miller was making this sort of appeal based on the notion of good Negro government, that they had been good governors as Negroes of South Carolina. But what Du Bois accurately saw was that what South Carolina feared more than bad Negro government was in fact good Negro government, that the good Negro government was actually the problem because it undercut the basic theories of white supremacy.
So it's fascinating. Your book is a collection of major magazine essays you wrote throughout the Obama years. It's a collection you say forms something of a loose memoir. Tell us what you learned about yourself, how you saw yourself during those years evolving.
Ooh. Well, I learned it's good to be lucky. That was the primary lesson. You know, the book begins literally with me in an unemployment office.
Exactly.
Unable to support any sort of writing career, unable to really, you know, not even support my family, effectively contribute in any sort of substantive way monetarily to my family, and really doubting the possibility of writing and reporting, being a journalist as a career path. And what basically happened was Barack Obama ran for president. He won. And a kind of curiosity opened up in the broader country. And what that meant was suddenly there was a market, you know, for the kind of things that I had been writing, you know, long before Barack, you know, President Obama actually ran for president. And what changed was that, you know, suddenly, you know, people wanted to read, you know, sort of things I was writing. I, you know, was able to suddenly support myself, which meant that I was able to actually work at writing. I was able to read a lot more because I had more time, you know. And so my writing deepened, thickened up a bit. It changed. It just, you know, the whole period had a huge impact on me as a writer.
And Bill Cosby played a big part in your first essay for The Atlantic magazine.
Yes, he does. That was the first big piece I got, you know, for The Atlantic. And I think, like, one of the interesting things about that piece, you know, I believe the first sentence of that chapter, the preceding intro, is this story begins as all writing must in failure, or something like that.
Yeah.
And the chapter ends, you know, me talking about the failure, you know, of the Bill Cosby piece, which was not really to grapple with the numerous, even then at that point, sexual assault allegations against him. And there are various points like that all through the book where you try to grapple with, you know, what you did right, what you did wrong. I don't think every essay in here is a success. That's not, you know, the conclusion that I drew, you know, looking back on it. But I did want to tell the story of the evolution of myself as a writer. And so it felt necessary to, you know, include even those pieces that were important, but weren't necessarily successful.
But I want to take you back to that first moment when you learned that The Atlantic was going to accept your piece. Tell me what that felt like.
Whew. So I was on unemployment, and, oh, man. I had been working at Time Magazine, where I had been on probation at one point. They were trying to fire me. And then, you know, they had to lay off people, and I was the only writer in the office who'd gotten laid off. And while I was there, and I was trying to pursue the same sort of questions I pursue now. And before that, I had lost two other jobs. You know, my son was relatively young. He had been born, you know, only a few years earlier. And I could not hold down a job, and I lost this one. Now, the only thing when you're a reporter about losing your job is you get to take your reporting with you. And so at the time, I had been working on this piece about Bill Cosby, and I just couldn't place it. I tried, you know, various different places and, you know, or places where I had a relationship, really. And I wasn't able to place it. And I called up my buddy David Carr, used to be of the New York Times, you know, passed away in 2015. And I called him up and I said, you know, do you know anybody at The Atlantic? And he did. He knew, you know, James Bennett, who was the editor at the time. I sent my pitch over to James. He saw it, liked it. He had an editor call me. I was at home, as I said, on unemployment. And the editor said to me, well, how about 8,000 words? Now, for a writer, you know, in a magazine, that's a lot of space to play with and a lot of canvas to do something creative. So I was blown away by that. And then he said, wow, about $2 a word. And I said, my God, $16,000 to write an article? I mean, you know, when I was pulling in about one or two, I don't know, something, some, you know, maybe like $2,000, some ridiculously low amount of money. I said, my God, this is huge. You know, I had to sit down on the bed and I said, can you say that again? insisted that, you know what I mean? No, I hadn't heard what I heard, but it was a huge break. It was a huge opportunity. And see, what you have to understand is even, you know, $16,000 is a lot of money.
You bet.
But you spread that over the time it takes to write that article. So I probably got that opportunity in April of 2007, and the piece was only published a year later. Wow. And you don't get the money until the piece is done.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was good money, but it was a lot of work.
You know, that hardship of money you talk about and how it imposed on you both physically and emotionally.
Yeah, and, you know, I struggled with that because I didn't want to it's always awkward to talk about money. It's just really, really awkward to talk about money. But I did that more than anything for people who are aspiring to write. If you watch movies and TV, you know, shows about writers, it looks like, you know, it's a relatively easy, you know, life existence, you know, in terms of being able to support yourself. But it's actually much more akin to being an actor or a singer, at least the kind of journalism I was doing, which is magazine journalism at the time. It's much, much closer to that. And it imposed a lot. You know, it made it difficult for me to develop. If you can't get the time to actually practice your form, if you don't have the space, by which I mean the pages, to practice your form on, it's hard to get better.
You know,
it's hard to get better when you write about, you know, basic things in terms of your life.
You know, Ta-Nehisi, you say that President Trump is the first white president, one who was elected in direct response to Obama, our first black president. Explain what you mean.
Well, I mean that whiteness is always conceptual. So whiteness, you know, throughout all of, you know, most of all of, I guess, recorded history, you've had people with fairer skin or blonde hair or straighter hair or, you know, blue eyes or green eyes or whatever, you know, phenotypical features you typically associate with whiteness. We have not always deemed those people to be white. And even when we did deem them to be white, we didn't necessarily attach much value to that fact beyond the descriptive, beyond the kind of value that, you know, in the black community, we ascribe to people who we call light skin or dark skin or brown skin. You know, it wasn't necessarily political valence attached to that. And on top of that, you know, in America, we've had people and have people who phenotypically, you know, are you know, could be classified as white, but are not, due to their ancestry. So the mere phenotypical appearance and the possession of European ancestry is clearly not enough. Whiteness has a kind of political valence. And in America, it's always been positioned against blackness. It is what it means to be not. You know, black people are the impure. We're the Mongols. And I mean that in terms of our very ancestry. If you did a DNA test, and I hate to go here, of, you know, your average African American, you would find something on the order of 20% of quote unquote white or European ancestry. To be white is to be pure. It's to be anti. It's to be different. And that's exactly how Donald Trump ran his campaign. He was not Barack Obama. He began it, you know, in a very, you know, explicitly sort of, you know, racist way with, you know, the appeal to birtherism. Now, I'll say that, you know, any, you know, candidate who's running generally, you know, tries to, you know, from an opposition party, does try to establish distance. But it seemed like the main question for Trump was not even whether something was good or bad policy, was it liberal or conservative, but was Obama for it? That kind of opposition, the fact that he had an entire program that had been racialized, you know, from Obamacare on down that he could run against, that's what makes him the first white president.
Yeah.
Of course, there have been previous presidents who checked white on a census form, but he didn't have another foil at a presidential level to measure themselves against.
And that article that you've written titled The First White President is in the October issue of The Atlantic. I was fascinated to read that, as so many have said, it was the disgruntled white working class in this country. It was not they, but whites who were actually doing quite well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, some, you know, sort of argument says, well, he got most of his support, you know, from whites making somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000, which is not working class if you're black, by the way. That's something a little bit more. You're doing pretty well if you're black. But it's not as though, you know, whites of other, you know, economic persuasions did not vote for him across the board. You know, on any, you know, sort of demographic analysis of the white community, Trump got pretty broad support. If you're going to say, you know, you can say that the white working class is his base. But, you know, as I argue in the essay, one of those adjectives is more important than the other. If economics were the, you know, the trend line that you wanted to look for, that you wanted to say was the most important, then it would be true that white and that black and Latino working class people would also have broken for Trump. But they did. They did. It's pretty clear that the vector in which you find consistent majority support for Trump is not being working class. It's being white.
Being white. Mm-hmm. So against a black president.
Yeah, measured against, yes.
Measured against. You know, you also mention in that Atlantic piece our country's stark difference of reaction to first the opioid crisis and one that now includes whites.
Yeah, yeah, and it's sad to see. And I don't want to overgeneralize this because I'm not, I don't want to portray it as our response to the opioid crisis has been sufficient. It has not. But what you don't see is the kind of racialized rhetoric that you saw around the crack era. You know, this the pseudoscience of crack babies. You know, the notion that, you know, people, the portrayal of people on crack as less than human. The idea that the way to deal with crack, you know, the crack era, was to expand, you know, the prison population. This sort of overly dehumanizing rhetoric. It's just not the same. The response is not the same. And I actually think this has consequences for the opioid epidemic, because had we been more sympathetic in dealing with the crack epidemic, who knows what you know, patterns and practices we might have pioneered during that period that could be applied today in terms of drug rehab. But we neglected to do that. We responded almost totally with a punitive model.
You know, I'm fascinated with what happened in Puerto Rico and how the U.S. responded as compared to what we did when Haiti suffered that massive earthquake.
Yeah, and obviously the difference being that Puerto Ricans are Americans. So the contrast is even more stark. But again, I think, you know, the difference is that in one case you have a president for whom whiteness is not a definitive factor in his identity. And then you have one this time where it is, you know. And so the notion that he would be particularly sympathetic or even just sympathetic in the way, you know, normal folks would be is not particularly shocking. You know, Trump comes out of a particular base, and I don't know he's that far from his base's feelings about Puerto Ricans.
So you write that not every Trump voter is, would call him or herself a white supremacist, but every Trump voter felt it was acceptable to turn the fate of the country over to one.
That's exactly it. That's exactly. Not only would they not call themselves that, you know, I think like 95% probably wouldn't call themselves that. Which is fine, but it's not. It's pretty obvious that they don't find being one disqualifying. They don't find racism disqualifying. You know, it's like interesting when I wrote the case for reparations. You know, one of the big sort of critiques I got was, well, what about Native Americans? Isn't there a case for Native Americans? And I said, yes, there is. There is. I mean, one, I could imagine, you know, somebody writing an essay strictly looking at the campaign between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and arguing that he's also the first male president. You know, because it's the first time when you had a guy, you know, really able to define his manhood, his maleness, his machismo in opposition to a woman running for president. It's a separate piece, but it's not a piece that I think contradicts. In other words, it's not that his whiteness and, you know, his sort of white supremacy is the only factor. It's an essential factor, but I don't even think it's the only essential factor. It's one essential factor, which I focus on.
I thought his comments to the mayor of Puerto Rico were absolutely outrageous. My thinking. What's yours?
I agree. They were. They were. But also, you know, predictable given who he is. You know?
And she is a female.
She is. She is. And that was part of it. That was definitely part of it. You know, Diane, with my work, what I hope is that people who have different experiences, who are coming from a different perspective, who are pointing right on different things, I hope it lends some amount of inspiration for them to explore the same sort of subject matter that I explore, but with a different lens. That really is, you know, so I can never, you know, do it all. I can never, you know, capture the whole thing. But if anything, I hope that it, you know, it serves as a model for folks to, you know, do the same thing I do, but from a different perspective.
But here you are, Ta-Nehisi, unemployed for quite some time, enough so that you were depending on your girlfriend's salary for a long time. And now here you are saying, I'm writing about this, and I really, really want you to read it and understand where I'm coming from. Why should people want to do that?
I don't know why they should read it. That's a tough thing for me to answer. You know, I've spent the past few months in the bubble of actually trying to build the thing. I hope they find it beautiful. I hope they find it heartbreaking. You know, I hope they, you know, are able to get some amount of wisdom out of it. But that'll have to be up to the reader.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, what a pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. That number, 202-854-8851, or go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. Our engineer is Timothy Olmsted. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman, with help this week from Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.